An era of war. The 15th and 16th centuries saw an interesting mix of warfare and high culture. During the latter half of the 15th century, the most influential warrior clans, including the Ashikaga, suffered from internal succession disputes that became violent. Even after those conflicts burned through Kyoto over the course of a decade, the rest of Japan experienced a new kind of warfare fundamentally different from anything it had experienced before. Battles were no longer conducted under the logic of chasing down enemies in the name of punishing rebels, Genpei War, or uppity emperors, Jokyu War. Warriors fought to expand and defend territory. Like previous wars, the Onin War, 1467 to 1477, originated from the structural tensions at the political top. Three warrior clans, the Hosokawa, Hatakeyama, and Shiba, served as military governors, but also rotated among themselves a newly created position during the Muromachi shogunate known as a deputy shogun. After the death of the third shogun, Yoshimitsu, died 1408, the subsequent shoguns no longer had the ability or influence to control the shogunate on their own. Nor was there a single family like the Hojo, connected to the shogun via marriage, powerful enough to dominate. Therefore, the deputy shogun and his family cooperated with the other clans to maintain stability in the shogunate. It was an efficient system when the clans were internally cohesive and interacted well. Their rivalry ensured that no single clan dominated. But when the clans were not strong, or when tensions arose among the deputy shogun families, the shogunate weakened. Disputes that broke out within these families were tied to issues of who would control the shogunate at any given moment. Moreover, military governors, in what was a temporary post with little authority during the Kamakura era, gradually began to function as semi-autonomous lords. It was easy to dismiss the Ashikaga clan entirely after the death of its last great leader, the third shogun Yoshimitsu. Even after he retired, he still controlled the shogunate through his son, the fourth shogun. Warriors, nobles, and even the Ming Chinese respected Yoshimitsu, but they despised his son. The fifth shogun died young, and the sixth shogun, Yoshinori, who showed some real ability to rule, was deemed too tyrannical by many of the important military families, and for good reason. Cooks who underperformed, gardeners who broke a tree branch on a plum tree, 59 members of the nobility, and even some warriors were killed, purged, or fled for their lives from his wrath. The military governor Akamatsu Mitsuide brutally assassinated Yoshinori after learning that Yoshinori might take land from him and give it to someone else. Mitsuide held a party in his villa on the outskirts of Kyoto and invited Yoshinori and other prominent warriors to partake in a favorite warrior pastime, viewing no theater. Horses suddenly rushed through the gardens, creating a distraction and allowing the assassins to break in and decapitate Yoshinori. A courtier at the time wrote that Yoshinori died like a dog. His son, the seventh shogun, died in childhood, so the shogun's position passed to another son, the much maligned Yoshimasa. Although Yoshimasa represented the height of warrior involvement in noble culture, he was an accomplished poet, he was an indecisive shogun who had just enough influence in the shogunate to destroy it. Wanting to retire and having failed to produce an heir, he asked his brother Yoshimi to take over the shogun position. He planned to formally adopt his brother, a common solution for warriors who needed to secure an heir when no biological son was forthcoming. Yoshimi, quite rightly, was suspicious. What if Yoshimasa's wife suddenly gave birth to a son? And besides, Yoshimi, like other noble sons no longer in line to become head of the family, was happily ensconced in an unrelated career, in his case, as a Buddhist abbot. Unfortunately for everyone involved, after Yoshimi accepted his brother's offer, Yoshimasa's wife gave birth to a son. The various supporters of Yoshimi and his newborn nephew battled it out in Kyoto, exacerbating an already volatile situation that grew into the Onin War. The fighting of the Onin War signaled a shift toward a new kind of combat. Although some of the fighting occurred in the countryside, most of it took place inside the city of Kyoto itself. It represented neither the earlier logic of hunting criminals and rebels, nor the engagement of participants in open field combat. Defensive blocks of men armed with pikes proved better suited to urban warfare than mounted warriors. Fighting occurred haphazardly in yards, gardens, and streets by those who were not warriors as such, but commoners recruited to fill the ranks of otherwise small armies. The purpose was simply to defeat an enemy, and in many cases, to exact revenge. In previous wars, when an elite opponent was not decapitated, he would be allowed to retire in exile. But during the Onin War, violence was so intense that some warriors made cups from an enemy's lacquered skull. The war was so devastating that when a reporter asked the 17th head of the Hosokawa family, Hosokawa Morisada, father of Prime Minister Hosokawa Morihiro, 1993-1994, about his family's legacy, Morisada replied, "Yes, our family used to have many excellent treasures, but they burned up during the war." The reporter thought that the war referred to World War II, but Morisada clarified, "Oh, by the war, I mean the Onin War." The shogunate itself never fully recovered, and warriors who remained in the countryside began to assert themselves against their neighbors, rivals, and absentee superiors. With Kyoto destroyed, many of its residents flooded out of the city to the growing number of castle towns being erected around Japan. Military governors, who focused their energies on regional bases, continued to maintain power locally, but others with little or no connection to prominent warrior families fought to obtain and secure territory. Contemporaries invoked Chinese history to describe the era as a time of warring states, referring to the conflicts in antiquity immediately before the founding of Imperial China. Skill in warfare alone was not enough. Warlords needed to monopolize trade, encourage commerce, increase income, and attract noble-born literate men from Kyoto to establish laws that helped them pacify the realm. No potential alliance was overlooked as they gathered warriors, mercenaries, and non-combatant supporters to serve them. It is no wonder that a Jesuit missionary writing to his brethren in Europe referred to these warlords as kings. Domains were neither states nor kingdoms, but a warlord wielded authority in his realm with little regard for the shogunate, a far cry from the pre-Onin War military governors. The bottom overthrowing the top was a phrase used at the time to describe the phenomenon of relatively unknown aspirants taking control of a domain or carving out a slice of land on their own. Even warlords with an impressive lineage were not guaranteed victory. The Ōchi family, which had once supported the Ashikaga during the conflict between the northern and southern courts, was one such prominent clan that fell into obscurity. They dominated southern Japan and ruled their coastal domain from a castle town called Yamaguchi. There, they accrued wealth from trade with nearby Korea and China, and eventually European traders, who began arriving in Japan during the 16th century. At one point, Yamaguchi became so economically dynamic that it rivaled Kyoto itself, and the Ōchi even planned to move the emperor permanently to Yamaguchi. Eventually, however, the Ōchi were overthrown by one of their vassal clans, the Mori, and Yamaguchi collapsed, never to regain its former glory. The shogunate remained a potential source of legitimacy for warlords like Oda Nobunaga, 1534-1582. Nobunaga was the first of three warlords to conquer large swaths of territory and pacify the country. Nobunaga's rise to power illustrates how a warlord took advantage of upheaval. His family, the Oda, were only minor warrior vassals serving the Shiba, a branch of the Ashikaga clan. The Shiba rotated the deputy shogun position with the Hosokawa and the Hatakeyama, and like them, the Shiba were weakened from internal family disputes of the sort that characterized the Onin War and were unable to control warriors in their provincial lands. The Oda, who carried out mundane functions in the province on behalf of the absentee Shiba, overthrew the Shiba and took over the province. Nobunaga inherited titles and land from his father, but he had to spend many years securing control over the Oda clan. As was true throughout warrior history, family members were targets. Nobunaga killed his brother. He also negotiated with local influential men in the province, a necessary strategy because the province, Owari, was centrally located, close to Kyoto, and agriculturally productive. A combination of political alliances, strategic and tactical skills, and Nobunaga's ability to incorporate the men of his defeated enemies drove his success. Eventually, he attracted support from the shogun Ashikaga Yoshiaki. The two men needed each other. Yoshiaki required Nobunaga's military might, and Nobunaga wanted the legitimizing approval of the shogun, regardless of how weak the shogunate might have become. But Nobunaga never accepted titles from the shogun. Doing so would have made him the shogun's subordinate and complicated Nobunaga's ambitions. As with the Hojo and Go Toba in 1221, and Ashikaga Takauji and Go Shirakawa during the 1330s, Nobunaga was forced to defend himself against an older institution of rule, using force to do so. Nobunaga probably did not set out to destroy the political relevance of the shogun and his regime, but relations between the two men waned. Yoshiaki sought help from Nobunaga's rivals, including the powerful warlord Takeda Shingen, who, like Nobunaga, had successfully conquered large swaths of territory. Nobunaga, in turn, sent Yoshiaki a list of complaints about the shogun's behavior. Eventually, the shogun declared war on Nobunaga in 1573, and despite Nobunaga's offers of peace, he lost patience with Yoshiaki, who fled Kyoto, never to return. Nobunaga defeated Yoshiaki's coalition and ordered the beheading of the shogun's top three warlords. He then had their heads lacquered and painted in gold dust to show to the troops. Nobunaga eliminated his final enemy, institutional Buddhism, over the course of the next several years, killing tens of thousands of adherents of the true Pure Land faith, including commoner men and women. In so doing, he forever eliminated Buddhism as an institution of rule. For more than 500 years, major temples had enjoyed patronage from the Kyoto aristocracy and warrior elites. After Nobunaga's campaign, temples no longer maintained armies or possessed the wealth they once did. In 1582, the court, which had supported him since his victory over the shogun, offered him the title of shogun. But before he could accept, one of his own generals, Akechi Mitsuhide, attacked him, cornering him and his son in a temple. Wounded and clearly defeated, both Nobunaga and his heir committed suicide after ordering that their bodies be burned. Nobunaga's career ended as it had started, in the constant bottom overthrowing the top that defined the times. Nobunaga had conquered about a third of Japan, established policies to encourage trade, and amassed a sizable army, but as with any warlord, the issue arose as to who would inherit that legacy. His remaining son, Nobutaka, was far from Kyoto when news arrived that his father and older brother had been killed. He blamed his cousin for the betrayal, as kinsmen were the usual suspects in prominent warrior families. He was forced aside, leaving one of Nobunaga's generals, Hideyoshi, to avenge Nobunaga and take control of his forces. Nobunaga exemplified one type of warring states story, a vassal family usurping their patrons. Hideyoshi represented another type, an individual of obscure, lowly origins who rose through the ranks. He and his early biographers cultivated this image, He told foreigners that a ray of sunlight had entered his mother's womb, indicating divine birth. In other words, he used both sides of the classic hero story, the everyman of humble beginnings, and also divine birth that would lead to heavenly ordained greatness. At any rate, he built on Nobunaga's gains and secured alliance, obedience, and dominance from warlords across Japan. He accomplished this by fielding the largest army in the world at the time, as many as 200,000 men, much larger than any contemporaneous European army. He personally owned 12% of Japan, including some of the largest cities, such as Kyoto, and the major ports that handled lucrative trade from China, Korea, and European merchants. We should not attribute Hideyoshi's successes to his abilities alone. The warlords themselves were willing to acquiesce to his policies so that they could block threats from within their domains. After all, only a few decades before Hideyoshi's unification, the vassal family Mori had overthrown their lords, the Ōchi. The final decades of the late 16th century and early years of the 17th are a story of preventing the types of upheaval that many of these warlords themselves took advantage of. For example, warriors were removed from villages to keep them from building local power bases independent of the warlord's authority. Hideyoshi tried to disarm villagers, knowing that local people posed a significant threat to his conquest over Japan. They sometimes created egalitarian leagues of farmers, merchants, mercenaries, militant monks, and other non-warriors who nonetheless armed themselves and fought collectively. Warrior was still an ambiguous term. Often there was no clear distinction between who counted as a warrior and who did not. People of all statuses joined together to form leagues that protected their members against warlords with large armies. An attack on one member of a league prompted a response from them all, something like a pre-modern Japanese North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Geographic proximity, or even a shared religious affiliation, was enough to justify collective defense. Hideyoshi solidified his conquest in 1590, but his vision extended beyond Japan to China, and he started what became the largest war in pre-modern world history, the Imjin War, 1592 to 1598. Not long after Hideyoshi had unified Japan, he sent messengers to European representatives in Asia, the Spanish governor of the Philippines and the Portuguese stationed in their colony of Goa, now a state in India. They responded with a mix of confusion and minimal acknowledgement of this man whom they had never heard of before, but Hideyoshi took their response as recognition of his greatness. Such was the extent of Hideyoshi's confidence. He asked the Korean king to allow him access to the peninsula to make way for his armies that would conquer China. The Koreans demurred, and in 1592 Hideyoshi ordered warlords, mostly from the south, to lead their samurai to Korea. Many have speculated about why Hideyoshi invaded Korea. Some have argued that he wanted to keep the warlords and their samurai busy to prevent a revolt. Although this is not a consensus view, it has one element of truth, namely that Hideyoshi liked to move warlords around to keep them occupied and their resources strapped. Others believe that he wanted to rid himself of Christian warlords. Nearly a quarter of a million Japanese had converted to Christianity since Catholic missionaries had arrived in the latter half of the 16th century. Most conversions occurred in the southwest, on the island of Kyushu, where missionaries first landed as they traveled north along maritime routes from South and Southeast Asia, earning them the name in Japan of Southern Barbarians. Many warlords sent to Korea were among the converts. Initially, the Imjin War went well for the Japanese. Nearly 158,000 men, at least twice as many as in any European army, invaded from the south and made it to the northern capital in a few weeks. For the Korean kingdom of Joseon, it was the perfect storm. The Koreans' military organization was not good, the peninsula had been at relative peace for centuries, and now they were facing battle-seasoned Japanese. the Korean king called upon his patron, the Ming Chinese emperor, who sent a small force. Initially, the emperor had not felt threatened by the Japanese, until the first army he dispatched was wiped out. Eventually, he sent an army of approximately 100,000. Chinese support and the Korean naval successes under Admiral Yi Sun-shin, who cut off Korea-based troops from Japan, forced the Japanese to retreat. For several years, Hideyoshi engaged in peace talks with the Ming, during which time some Japanese soldiers gave up arms and blended into local Korean communities or defected to the Ming army. Finally, shortly before dying of illness, Hideyoshi gave the order to retreat completely. The warlords were all too happy to comply. The war devastated Korea, which took centuries to recover. In the modern period, the Imjin War became the first historical source of tension between Korea and Japan. Attempts to rectify this tension have failed. In Kyoto, for instance, there is a national historical site called Ear Mound, which is a bit misleading. 20,000 Korean noses were buried there. Warriors had brought them back to Japan instead of decapitated heads for reward. During the 1990s, there was a campaign by South Koreans and Kyoto city officials to remove the mound and send its contents to South Korea for proper burial. But Japan's central government denied the request because it was designated a national cultural asset. Until recently, Chinese scholars have downplayed the war's impact on Ming China. After all, Japanese warriors never made it to China. But the Ming emperor committed enough resources to the Korean campaign, as it was known in China, that it drained Ming coffers. This made it more difficult for the Chinese ruler to put down rebellions from within China and fight enemies to the north. Japanese warlords brought back with them Korean slaves, especially artisans and intellectuals. Among them were potters who were forced to establish Korean ceramic workshops in Japan. In fact, Hideyoshi's invasion was also called the Pottery War. Why did daimyo want intellectuals and potters? What was the connection between warfare and culture? Warrior values. From the beginning, elite warriors depended upon connections to Kyoto that required some degree of cultural literacy. A significant number of shoguns during the Kamakura era came from Kyoto noble families with no military identity as such. Warrior regimes in Kamakura and then in Kyoto, as well as small local governments, drew talent from middling noble families. Thus, it should be no surprise that elite literate warriors participated in and patronized art in its many forms, from art collecting and poetry writing to the funding of Buddhist temples, statues, and religious artwork. The city of Kamakura even had its own Zen Buddhist temple system that mirrored the one in Kyoto. For warriors with court rank ambitions, writing was essential for interacting with elite nobility and clergy. But we should not think of poetry in the modern sense of the term as a leisure activity, a pastime with no function beyond observations about contemporary society. Poetry in pre-modern Japan could be used to comment on current events, but more important, poetry demonstrated one's knowledge of classical Chinese and Japanese literature. Good writing, in content and in form, handwriting mattered, was a means for noblemen in Kyoto to climb the career ladder. The monk Jien exchanged poetry with Yoritomo, which led to a mutually beneficial relationship. Jien needed to secure rights for his estate, and Yoritomo wanted information from him. People also wrote poetry together as a social activity, linking one poem to another. An elite warrior could expose himself to public humiliation if he failed to write adequately. As warriors took up permanent residence in Kyoto during the Muromachi period, they deferred to courtier sensibilities. They intensified the adoption of aristocratic culture into their own families, using Chinese learning when creating their own clan rules, and forming a parallel set of warrior etiquette that mimicked aristocratic traditions. In other words, nascent warrior culture and identity had its roots in noble culture. One text that imparts what it meant to be a proper warrior is a letter purportedly written during the early 15th century by a military governor, Imagawa Ryoshun, to his son. It emphasizes the importance of non-military learning, respect for the clan over the individual, and the way to manage a clan and its properties. The text was not written in a historical vacuum. Some themes had appeared in earlier warrior texts for elites. Buddhist notions of the respect for life and Confucian ideas about proper behavior when interacting with others punctuate Imagawa's letter, as they did many early East Asian writings. The Imagawa House Code includes these precepts. As you do not understand the arts of peace, your skill in the arts of war will not in the end achieve victory. You like to roam about, hawking and cormorant fishing, relishing the purposeless taking of life. To build your own dwelling, you raised the pagoda and other buildings of the memorial temple of our ancestors. You permit yourself to forget the kindness that our Lord and Father showed us. Thus, you destroy the principles of loyalty and filial piety. You disregard other people's viewpoints. You bully them and rely on force. You excel at drinking bouts, amusements, and gambling, but you forget the business of our clan. Expertise in the military arts and warfare are the way of the warrior. What first makes him distinguished is the capacity for management. It appears clearly from the four books of Confucianism, the five classics of China, and military texts that he who can only defend his territory but has no learning cannot govern well. These precepts did not necessarily apply to lower-ranking warriors, but to elite men like Imagawa. Only the upper echelons of the warrior community had access to an education that allowed them to read the Chinese classics. In fact, familiarity with Chinese philosophy can help the modern student of samurai history understand warrior ideals. During the 15th and 16th centuries, military governors and warlords used Imagawa's letter in their own clans and adopted it to create similar teachings. The Imagawa letter reached the peak of its popularity during the Tokugawa period, 1600 to 1868, an age of peace when warrior education focused on management and civil learning, not military skill. Warrior thought is also reflected in the teachings of Hojo Soun, a 15th century warrior loyal to the Imagawa clan during the Warring States era. He was not directly related to the Hojo clan of the Kamakura period, 1185 to 1333, but consciously adopted the surname in order to inherit their powerful legacy. Warriors idealized the past. His teachings spread throughout all warrior ranks in the lands he controlled, including such aphorisms as these. Rise early in the morning. If you wake up late, your servants will be negligent and they will be of no use to you. Your public and private affairs will go into disarray. Your lord will forsake you. Think carefully about this. Do not think that you should have fine swords and clothes like others have. Just be sure they do not appear slovenly. That's enough. You'll be ridiculed if you borrow what you don't have or spend too much effort on such things. In seeking good friends, find those who are good at writing and learning in general. Bad friends to exclude are those who play go, shogi, a form of chess, the flute, or the shakuhachi, an end-blown bamboo flute. It is not a shame to be ignorant of those pursuits. These are simply ways to pass the idle time. The good and bad of a man is determined by the friends he keeps. Then, quoting the Analects of Confucius, when three men walk together, among them I have teachers. I choose to follow what is good about the good man and learn to better myself from the bad man. Of course, you should know the ways of culture, bun, and war, bu, along with the military arts, literally bow and horse. There is no need to write more about this. From antiquity, it has been the rule that civil culture is on the left and military learning is on the right. One must practice both. So-un also has much to say about how to serve one's lord. Always show respect to one's seniors, follow orders to the letter and without delay, and maintain one's residence. Like the Imagawa letter, So-un's writing deems civil arts to be just as important as the martial arts. Warriors in Kyoto culture. During the Muromachi period, warriors also began entering the Kyoto artistic realm, not of their own making, the world of art collecting, connoisseurship, and performance. The intertwining of politics and art intensified with the Ashikaga presence in Kyoto. Even the relatively uninitiated, like Oda Nobunaga, could not resist the social and political gains to be made by engaging the nobility and wealthy commoners through art. What we might today think of as traditional Japanese culture, such as no theater or the tea ceremony, expanded during an era of war and benefited from warrior patronage. These activities became new fields of knowledge as artists themselves created new types of networks by interacting with the nobility and warrior patrons. Theater had long existed in Japan, but we know few details about it until it became an artistic field of knowledge, written about and codified as no during the 14th and 15th centuries. That is, there were no texts that attempted to define theatrical standards, training, or aesthetics. It was only when Zeami, regarded as the creator of no, received patronage from the third Ashikaga shogun, Yoshimitsu, that he had connections to intellectuals who provided him with the education and vocabulary to elevate theater from entertainment to high art. No played to its newfound audience. Many performances featured warrior heroes, drawing from the classic tale of Heike. Art had a practical function. Warriors gained access to social networks among non-warriors through cultural activities. Only after spending time in Kyoto with nobles did Nobunaga start practicing kemari, often referred to as kickball, but closer to hacky sack. Nobles and even Kamakura shoguns hired kemari teachers to improve their game, and other elite warriors wanted to become involved. Likewise, art collecting allowed warriors to mingle with the wealthy and to form alliances with other warriors through gift-giving or by bestowing rewards on subordinates. The tea ceremony was among the iconic aristocratic pastimes that moved into the warrior sphere and eventually came to represent it. The tea ceremony combined two activities, collecting and connoisseurship, with physical practice. Tea gatherings began as social events where rare objects could be displayed, perhaps as a part of other day-long events such as poetry writing or even gaming. But gradually, it became an intimate affair when a few men of varying social classes gathered in a small, unassuming room where attention centered on the host, who would prepare the tea for his guests. Here, too, Nobunaga is often regarded as the first prominent warrior who engaged in this practice, keeping two well-known tea experts on his payroll, including Sen no Rikyu, the first tea master to write extensively about tea aesthetics, and whose teachings are followed even today. Hideyoshi, like other warriors, took his cultural cues from Nobunaga. He continued to employ Rikyu, relying on him almost as a collaborator. Rikyu helped Hideyoshi set up tea gatherings, display tea-related objects, and learn the aesthetics of tea as defined and redefined by Rikyu. Hideyoshi even held a large open-air tea event, inviting anyone, regardless of status, to attend. But the constantly changing world of tea clashed with warrior desire to impose order. Those who did not attend the event were forbidden to participate in future communal tea gatherings. One can imagine the tension between a hegemon with designs on conquering China and his tea master, who was regarded as a cultural icon. As an indication of his importance, Rikyu oversaw the installation of a statue of himself over the gate of an important Zen temple. This was regarded as an insult to Hideyoshi, who might pass under Rikyu's feet. In 1591, Hideyoshi ordered Rikyu to kill himself. After writing a death poem and piercing his abdomen with a short sword, he was shown the mercy of decapitation by a warrior in attendance. Whatever reasons Hideyoshi might have had for executing Rikyu, the tea master nonetheless represented a challenge to Hideyoshi's authority in the world beyond politics and war. People obeyed Hideyoshi, but they listened to Rikyu.